Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We know him as the inventor of the telephone and the co-founder of AT&T, but Alexander Graham Bell, though proud of his invention, was much more focused on his work educating deaf people. Alexander Graham Bell was thoroughly immersed in the challenges of deaf people. Both his mother and his wife were deaf, but as we'll find out, his legacy is a complicated one in the deaf community today, as he, at one point, became involved in eugenics in a quest to end deafness altogether. Katie Booth explores the complexity of Bell's work and philosophy in her book, The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. Booth teaches writing at the University of Pittsburgh and was raised in a mixed hearing and deaf family, and her grandparents are part of this story, too. She joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I don't think that most people probably realize how entwined Alexander Graham Bell's life was with deaf people. And I want to say with the deaf community, but I actually think that that idea of a deaf community was challenged by him and others in his day. And we're going to get to that later. But let's start with Alexander. And I guess he went by Alec?
Yep.
Yeah. So his mother, Eliza, Alec's mother, Eliza, how did she influence his ideas about deaf people?
Well, Eliza, first of all, he really respected his mother a lot. He really looked up to her, and she was herself deaf. She had lost her hearing, I believe, around the age of 12, which meant she lost her hearing after having learned how to speak. And so she could still speak and sort of function in the hearing world in a way that made it so people didn't necessarily focus on her deafness. Bell used to sign with her very discreetly, or use the British Sign Alphabet sometimes, but for the most part, she moved throughout the world somewhat hiding her deafness. And I think he saw that and thought it could be possible for anyone.
Okay, so just take us back to when Alexander was born. I just want us all to remember what time period we're talking about here.
It's like the mid-1800s.
Okay, so in this time period, what were the thoughts about language and voice and, you know, kind of oral education in general for everybody compared to like teaching literacy and how many people could actually read and write?
That's a great question. At that time, literacy was often seen as more related to spoken language than written language. Being able to speak was really valued, overvalued. And in the United States, especially, speech had a way of coding sort of how quote unquote normal you are. And it was a time when we were very concerned about normality and sameness.
And I imagine, though, not everybody could read and write. So maybe there was kind of a natural reliance on speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Speech was often the way that written word, like literature was passed on through speech. Like Bell's grandfather and father often gave presentations of literature. You know, they would read Dickens. I believe it was his father who was said to read Dickens better than Dickens himself.
Well, let's talk about his father for a minute, because he was involved in projects that would later inspire Bell's work to aid the deaf. Can you tell us about some of his father's projects?
Sure. Yeah. His father was really focused on creating a phonetic alphabet. So an alphabet that could be used by any language. He thought this would help people learn how to speak other languages more clearly, learn how to communicate better across nations. And so he invented this alphabet that basically described how one would speak, that the actual characters showed or indicated the positions of the mouth and the strength of the breath and nasality and all sorts of things. And this eventually spun off into Bell's project, which was teaching the deaf to speak. He used his father's alphabet as a way to educate deaf children to speak.
Mm, okay. Now we have to talk about he was an inventor from, you know, his childhood. And he invented a speaking machine when he was a teenager. I'm just so intrigued by this. Will you describe it to us?
Yeah. This was it's like a little device that essentially he and his brother worked together to create a machine that could speak. It was an assignment from their father, and they sort of had to create the soft palate and a tongue that could move, and the throat, a larynx. And it didn't really say much. It just said the sound ma.
At least
it
said that.
Elementary, right?
Got to start with mom.
But Bell and his brother would use it. It sounded kind of weird too, and the neighbors thought that there was a crying baby, so they sort of used it to play pranks.
Mm. Well, they were teenagers.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about, because you've talked about how important it was to speak, and we know that Alexander, from his relationship with his mother, thought that deaf people could speak. Mm-hmm. But they already had sign language, right? You refer to that. And how prevalent was it in America? How prevalent was ASL in deaf schools or in the deaf community?
Yeah. All deaf schools used sign language. It was the mode of education for deaf children. And it was often a deaf child's first language access at all. Being unable to hear, they often did not pick up on English. I mean, you can imagine how difficult it would be to try to pick up on English without the ability to hear. And so sign language was sort of the fundamental language for the deaf community and for deaf education.
And yet there was this movement called oralism, which I had never really heard of before I looked at your book. And so you explain what that is?
Yeah, oralism is a movement of education that Bell really spearheaded. He didn't invent it, but he sort of came into it very early on. And it might have died out if not for his advocacy.
Huh.
It is a method of education that teaches deaf children to speak and lip read, or tries to. But more importantly, it does so while also oppressing and punishing, forbidding and punishing the use of sign language.
Hmm. Okay, so it's a matter of, if for somebody who's not like Bell's mom, who learned how to speak and then lost her hearing, someone who has never heard, then you have to, it's really a kind of a mechanical training where you are moving the mouth, you are performing sound, even though you're not getting feedback from your ears, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's unbelievably difficult. And students were really, really traumatized in these educations.
So it seems like if they're not allowed to communicate with sign, they're struggling with this. I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of time left in the day for learning, you know, math and history and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, was it that difficult, or am I overstating it?
You are not overstating it. Many people, including my own grandfather, went through these educations with no access to language because they didn't have use of an accessible language and they couldn't access English. And since that was the language of their educations were given through speech, they also had no access to their educations. Not to mention the fact that if you don't get language input fairly young, your mind, it changes the way your mind actually develops. So
you mean even if it's through signing, you're not talking about sound, you need to just understand the concept of signs represent thought and start to process that. That's what
absolutely.
You're saying.
Mm-hmm. Sign language wires the brain the same. I mean, it has its own unique characteristics, but in terms of language acquisition, sign language does that work as well as any spoken language.
Well, I think that his wife, Mamel, her education as a child reflects kind of the challenges and the goals of the oralist method. Would you tell us about her education?
Sure. Yeah. Mabel lost her hearing somewhat like Belle's mother after she already had language. She already had speech, but it wasn't as developed. She was still very young, around five or six. And so she lost her hearing through a really bad case of scarlet fever. And then her parents, who were sort of upper crust Bostonians, really wanted her to keep the speech that she already had. The idea of sign language to them seemed like it would mark her in some way. They didn't want her marked. Mm. And so they hired a special teacher for her, a teacher who would not use any sign language and who would really, really focus on delivering an education without sign. Though this teacher also really focused on developing Mabel's mind, she was much more focused on the content of the education than the quality of the speech. And so later in Mabel's life, when her parents wanted her speech to be improved, they ultimately sent her to Alexander Graham Bell, who became her teacher.
Mm. And I just need to clarify that they are also obviously learning lip reading. I mean, that's how they're, you know, that they're understanding what their interlocutor is saying, right?
Yeah. Lip reading actually wasn't, that came in early on in oralism, but I actually don't know that that was part of Mabel's early education. I'm not sure, but it should be stated that lip reading is incredibly difficult for most people. Mm. And it is not at all 100% accurate. The percentage accuracy is quite low. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's a very difficult and tiring work to do.
So when they're going to school, are they they're just reading or how are they taking in information?
Well, by the time the oralist movement was really underway, they were lip reading. Bell himself did not believe that lip reading was possible until he came to America and saw what was going on in the Boston school. Mabel herself was a very good lip reader.
Okay, so let's talk about their student-teacher relationship.
Yeah. A little icky.
How many years older than Mabel was Alexander Graham Bell?
He was about a decade older than her. The power dynamic there was for sure imbalanced.
And so how long did he tutor her? And was there a romance right from the beginning?
I don't think so. I think it developed slowly on Bell's part. She was his student for maybe about a year. And he fell in love with her. And when he sort of realized that, he ended their lessons and confessed his love to her parents.
Oh, well, that was responsible of him. That was good.
Yeah, yeah. That was.
Well, what did they think about it? I mean, were they impressed with him?
No, not really. They tried to stop it. They thought she was too young. I would say they were correct.
Because she's how old at this time?
She's 17.
Okay.
And they tried to prevent him from, they asked him not to speak of it for a year, to sort of keep it to himself.
Hmm. And did he do that?
No. Nope. No, he went and pursued her. He said that, he tried, actually. He did try. And then Mabel had this very gossipy cousin Mary, and cousin Mary leaked it to Mabel. And then Mabel wrote home to her mother demanding to know what was going on. And her mother sort of tried to tell her and then told Alex. And he sort of went into this fit of insomnia and ultimately, you know, jumped on a train and then a ferry and went out to Nantucket, where Mabel was staying, to deliver a letter in which he sort of bared his soul.
Katie Booth is the author of The Invention of Miracles, Language Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. Let's talk let's go back to some of his inventions, and because I want to see where his work with deaf people led to improvements and kind of guided his inventions. And I guess we should start with the telegraph.
Yeah, he was seeking to. Well, actually, we have to start with the deaf because the telegraph came from his pursuit of a machine that would help deaf people see speech. He was looking at these inventions like the manometric capsule, these inventions that essentially you would speak into a mouthpiece with a diaphragm, and the diaphragm would vibrate in response to voice. And then those vibrations were translated into either the flickering of a flame that you could watch, or, you know, a scrawl on smoked glass that would almost read like a sound wave type image. And his idea was that if you could make speech visible, then deaf kids could sort of practice speaking on their own without having somebody constantly sort of telling them if it was right or wrong. They could compare the sounds they were making with the sort of flame shape they were supposed to be creating.
Mm-hmm. And how did that work out?
I've
never heard of it, so I'm kind of assuming it didn't really work out.
It didn't. I mean, he didn't really use it that much that I know of. But I think it very quickly morphed into his thoughts on creating a multiple telegraph. And then the multiple telegraph ultimately sort of led him into inventing the telephone.
So once he's transmitted some sound waves through wire, how long does it take him to jump to transmitting voice? And I'd love you to kind of recreate the moment when he does it successfully for the first time with his, he's got a partner, I guess.
Yeah. Thomas Watson. They were sort of trying all these different things. And at one point, the legend goes, and this is contested, but the legend goes that he spilled something, some acid, and yelled to Watson, "Watson, come here, I need you," or something along those lines. And instead of hearing it over from the other room, he ends up hearing it over, he hears sound over the wire, and they move on from there.
Eventually he tried it out, I guess, at longer distances and realized, oh, this is going to change things. I mean, I don't think we could imagine life without a telephone, much less, you know, texting and smartphones and all of that. But did he right off the bat realize that this is going to change everything? This is revolutionary?
No, no one did. It seemed very cumbersome, in fact, because everybody was still thinking along the lines of the way communication worked with the telegraph. And with the telegraph, you had, you know, one person sending a message and one person receiving a message, and they were in offices, and the message was sent, you know, it was like a current that was sort of connecting and breaking. And it was very, very clear, right? And then you just needed somebody to interpret those messages back into English and send the message. So there was just tremendous clarity in that system, except that you needed these people who could read it, who could read Morse code. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bell's telephone was not clear. You had to shout, the connection was bad, the receivers needed a lot of work, constant maintenance. And so it seemed like a parlor trick more than something effective. They were like, why would we have people shouting at each other instead of just sending these very efficient messages?
Oh, I see.
But they weren't really thinking about how they could connect individuals. And that was what really transformed things, was when they realized the telegraph offices themselves could become essentially obsolete if we could sort of cut that middleman and just speak to each other. And that's what really made everyone realize just how powerful of an invention this was.
Katie Booth was raised in a mixed hearing and deaf family, and she's the author of The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. In just a moment, we'll hear some troubling history about Bell's theories of eugenics and deafness, and we'll meet some amazing deaf people from our guest's family. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're speaking with Katie Booth. She is the author of The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. Now, you've kind of already referred to his Alexander Graham Bell's, basically, he did not think that American Sign Language or sign language in general should be used in education, though he did know how to do it himself because of mm-hmm. being raised by a deaf mother. I just wonder if you could talk kind of about the social aspect. Remind us why it would be important not to use signs for him.
Well, it's the mid-19th century and – you know, so you're right smack in the middle of Victorian era, maybe not in the middle, but you're in the Victorian era. And there is this really strong sort of idea of sort of bodily restraint, of being prim and proper, right? And so I think people looked at sign language and saw the opposite of that. And I think that alarmed some people. But even stronger than that was this really intense fear of difference. Especially in America, where you have, we're coming out of the Civil War. So already our nation is fractured in a really fundamental way. You have Manifest Destiny. We're moving westward. We're encountering Native people. And we all know how horrific that encounter was for those peoples. Mm-hmm. And then you also have immigrants moving in. And so suddenly America is really confronted with difference in a way that maybe it hadn't been, or maybe hadn't been all at once in this way. And the idea of being normal gains tremendous, tremendous traction. People are really trying to sort of assimilate anyone in the phrase, sort of just pull them into this unified national identity, which language was a really big part.
And so I guess I can kind of understand where he was coming from when he began to advocate against deaf marriages, which is, so painfully ironic given that he's married to a deaf woman. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Interestingly, that irony was not lost on him. And yet he just never, I don't know. He had this idea that deaf people, when they married each other, were having lots and lots of deaf babies and were essentially creating what he called a deaf race. And he was very alarmed by that. He thought deafness might even overtake hearing at some point. And he also he had this fundamental hearing perspective that deafness was not desirable, that it was something no one would want to be, which is not true today, and it was not true then. And he jumped on the very, very early eugenics movement and started advocating for deaf people not to marry each other and not to have deaf babies.
And what about his own kind of marriage? Was that okay? Or did he encourage deaf people to find a hearing person so that maybe to reduce the chances that their children would be deaf?
Yeah, his own marriage would not have passed his own, assessment of who should be married, because he was also very concerned about about hearing people with deaf people in their families, of which, he was a hearing person with deaf people in his family. And so he was concerned about that. He wanted deaf people to marry hearing people with no ties to deafness, which is just, aside from the fact that it's just fundamentally wrong to ask that of people, it's also sort of culturally speaking kind of ridiculous to just, you're just trying to distance yourself more and more and more from people who will understand you.
And so what kind of reaction did he get from the deaf community? Because you said there already was, you know, they didn't necessarily think of themselves as lacking even then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there was immediate pushback. And it was really seen as the last straw. I mean, there had already been a strong deaf resistance to oralism, which deaf people immediately were able to tell that this was damaging to deaf children, and they were really trying to reason with Bell over that. And then Bell comes out with this, and he really starts to be seen not just as someone who's misguided and needs to sort of be educated or you know, persuaded, but now he's really seen as a threat. He's seen as dangerous, and he was dangerous.
And what is his wife, or even is his mother still alive? I mean, what are they thinking this whole time?
Oh, his wife, Mabel, is so fascinating because she is resistant to this, but she's very subtle about it. She doesn't write that much about it. But at one point she writes him a letter in which she says, you know, pretty frankly, that I think she said, I think the quote is something like, your deaf mute business is hardly human to you. You're very kind and gentle with the deaf children, but your interest in them lies in their deafness, not in their humanity. She also speaks back against the way he starts to use Helen Keller to promote his own ideas. Again, sort of pointing out that he's using deaf people. He is not truly interested in what's going on, especially since the evidence was there in front of him over and over and over again that what he was doing was causing great harm.
Give me an example of that.
Well, for example, one of his first students, George Saunders, was... So, you know, Bell was essentially in charge of this boy's education. He taught this boy in exchange for rent, actually. Mm-hmm. And yet, as George grew up, he never took to speech. He never had an ease with speech the way Mabel might have, although Mabel also, in her diaries, you can see that she was also struggling. But George ultimately he goes to Gallaudet and starts to meet deaf people, starts to become involved in the deaf community. And Bell sort of freaks out and tries to get him out of Gallaudet and tries to sort of pull him away from deaf people. And at that time, a deaf teacher, James Dennison, writes to Bell, and he's sort of trying to get Bell to see that George is struggling. His education is far behind where it needs to be. He's struggling with math. He's struggling with all these different things that now we know are direct results of language deprivation. But we didn't have that language at the time. And Bell just turned away from that resistance. He just insisted that his ideas were right, and that, you know, George could be taught to speak and George could, you know, succeed in the hearing world. When in fact, George struggled to find work. Bell often employed George. George ultimately found love with another deaf woman, Lucy Sweat, and Bell tried to interfere with their marriage, but they resisted and they married and they had two deaf children.
You mentioned you mentioned Helen Keller. So I think we just need to talk for a second about their relationship, Alexander Graham Bell's relationship with Helen Keller, and kind of the impact she had on the oralist cause.
Yeah. So Bell actually arranged Helen Keller's education, and she dedicated The Story of My Life, that book, to Bell. And especially early on, she was, so Helen Keller was first taught to read and write. And later she really wanted to speak. She requested to learn and ultimately was brought to Boston to take lessons from a teacher that Bell had trained. And she did learn to speak. And Bell sort of used her, at that time, oralism was starting to flounder, or at least Bell perceived that it was floundering. It was not as strong as he wanted it to be. He was hoping to have no resistance. He was still coming against resistance. And so he used Helen Keller's ability to speak as a way of arguing that, you know, if a deaf blind girl can learn to speak, then anybody can. And he sort of coached her in how to speak to a crowd. You know, he brought her in front of these huge gatherings of people at conferences, essentially to promote oralism, to promote speech, which she did. She was a young woman, and she did it up until around the time she went to college, I believe.
Katie Booth is the author of The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. I want to get to your own family's story. And you referred earlier to your grandfather's education. And it really is stands in contrast to your grandmother's education. Could you kind of tell us a little bit about both their histories?
Sure, yeah. So my grandfather grew up in a hearing family. They were a very loving family, I should say. Through no fault of their own, they did not know sign language, and they didn't have access to resources the way, you know, there's much greater access today. So they weren't able to sign with him, and so he didn't have sign language growing up, and he couldn't really access English either. So when he went to school, he had no language foundation to build on. And because his education was oralist, he went to school and still did not have an accessible language. So he graduated with no language at all.
Because he didn't go to a school that taught that. Did he just go to a normal school?
He went to a deaf school. Both of my parents went to the
school. Sorry.
Yeah, my grandparents both went to an oralist deaf school. At the time they were educated, most schools for the deaf were oral.
Okay.
And so he just had no access to his education. Whereas my grandmother grew up in a deaf family. Her siblings were all deaf, her parents were deaf. She grew up signing. She had full language access growing up, and then she was sent to school. Everyone knew how important education was. And so she was sent to school. But at that school, she was perceived as a threat because she knew sign language. And she was punished whenever she tried to sign. And she essentially learned that this way of being that was comfortable and accessible was shameful, and that she was supposed to learn how to speak and lip read and function more like a hearing person.
And was she able to do that?
No, very, very, very few deaf people were able to do that. Mm-hmm. Her education was traumatic for her.
And so as a hearing person, and your parents are both hearing?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm seeing you, and you grew up close to your grandparents, right? So you're moving in and out of these two worlds. Can you kind of describe what that was like and how well were you able to communicate with them?
Growing up, I had no problems communicating with them. I was, I learned sign language before I learned how to speak. I spent my days with them when my parents were at work I spent my days with my grandparents. So I spent my days in a signing environment. My mother made sure that I had access to books and videos that encouraged sign language and deaf culture. So I was really exposed to sign language and deaf culture in a way that, frankly, most deaf children are not. And so, it's funny, people often ask me, like, what was it like to grow up with deaf grandparents? And it's really, if you have language access, it's not any different. I mean, it's a different culture, but it wasn't like, it was just a different culture, a different language. However, what it did show me over and over and over again was the way that hearing people behave when they're confronted with deafness, when they encounter deafness, I should say. And that was really alarming to me as a child, watching the way people would avoid my grandparents or disregard them, talk down to them, stare at them. It taught me much more about hearing people than anything else.
Mm. You tell a story about being at the mall with your grandmother and the security alarms go off. Can you tell that story?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one thing that happened a lot was that hearing cashiers or waiters or waitresses would get very flustered. And the outcome of that when we were shopping was they would often forget to remove the security tags. So now you'll notice that, security alarms at stores have lights, but that was not the case when I was a child. And so, one day I came home and I told my mother that I didn't want to go shopping with my grandmother anymore. This was puzzling because who doesn't want to go shopping,
Right.
And ultimately, she sort of was trying to figure out what was going on. And ultimately, what came out was that what was happening repeatedly was we would go shopping, the cashier would forget to remove the security tag, and we would go through those security alarm things, and the alarms would go off. Though my grandmother would have no idea because there were not lights yet. And I was a child, I didn't really know. I was taking my cues from her, and so we would just keep walking. And then, security would come, and they would grab my grandmother, often from behind, which was very frightening, often very forcefully. They would be yelling, moving very quickly. And to me, they were the police. I had no, and I mean, essentially, they have that same role. And it was the type of situation that would often happen. I would try to explain that she's deaf, but there was just such, and still is such, widespread ignorance about what that means and how you approach people and how you make room for the possibility that somebody might not be the same as you.
Mm. Well, having grown up with these grandparents and you begin and you end your book with your grandmother's death, and there's there's just such a sweetness in your description of how you communicated with her. And I really just want to give you a chance to share that with us, because it's more than sign language, the way you describe it. I wonder if you could talk for just a minute as we wrap up about that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was and it wasn't more than sign language. I mean, there are so many parts of sign language that are parts of sort of general non-verbal communication. So sort of the reading of body language, the tenderness of that. There are all these cultural things that are attached to sign language. Like, you have to be really paying attention to somebody visually. So when you're listening to somebody, you're watching them. You're really attentive in a way that I don't think hearing people are. When we talk to each other, we're looking all over the place. We're not really looking at each other often. Sometimes we're doing something else. We're writing. We're doing this and that, which isn't to say that deaf people don't do that as well. But I just think that the deaf world trains your attention in a different way. Deaf people themselves would be better able to speak to this. I always felt very present with my grandparents, very very observant of the visual world in a way that I don't think I am when I'm in the hearing world.
So just finally, having done all this research on Alexander Graham Bell, his promotion of oralism, and then having grown up with this very close relationship with your grandparents, I just wonder if you can – is it even possible to sum up your feelings about his legacy?
Oh, it's so complicated. Having to look at him so closely for so long was really, really difficult. It was interesting to me to learn who he was as a human, because growing up, he was just a villain. But I have to say that my encounter with his humanity did not soften my rage in some ways against what he did to deaf people, especially, you know, looking so closely at what he did. You see all of the times that he had the evidence before him, and all of the times that his own ego, his own sense of being a savior, prevented him from actually seeing the people in front of him and what he was doing to them. I feel like I know him as a man, but I also feel like he has to be held responsible for what he did.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to share your stories and your research with us and your opinions. We really appreciate it here on Constant Wonder.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
Katie Booth teaches writing at the University of Pittsburgh and was raised in a mixed hearing and deaf family. She's the author of The Invention of Miracles, Language, Power, and Alexander Graham Bell's Quest to End Deafness. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
Tenery Taylor heard there. She's a producer for Constant Wonder, and I'm Marcus Smith. Of all the things a person might be able to hear in life, how would it be to be able to hear color? We're going to meet somebody who can when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've just learned about the deafness in the family of Alexander Graham Bell and how he approached deafness. Our five senses play such crucial roles in our lives that they're obviously worthy objects for wonder. All of this has got me thinking about music, in part because I'm a musician and have been from an early age, but also it's got me thinking about something called synesthesia, or a blending of the senses. And we did have a conversation not long ago with an aspiring musician who hears music as color. Annie Dickinson, her name. When I spoke with her, she was a high school student, and then she went on to study at the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston. I want you to hear a highlight from our conversation. It includes some music samples where she describes what she sees when she hears music.
Well, sensory overload is definitely something that I've dealt with quite a bit, but it usually happens when one or more of those things that you mentioned come together. So like if there was a jackhammer and someone was squealing their brakes and also someone was talking to me, like that's a lot of different noises with very distinct colors. And sometimes if it's a lot, my brain doesn't know how to process all of it. I know walking into an arcade, ooh, there's so many lights and so many sounds from all the games. That's straight highway to sensory overload right there.
I want to play a little bit of music for you that is orchestral, in fact. This is an excerpt, I believe, from Swan Lake. And let's listen.
Ooh, I like Swan Lake.
And I hope we don't give you any sensory overload here. We'd better leave it right there because then there's going to be too much to comment on. You're a musician. You listen to music. You just said that you like Swan Lake. What were you experiencing between the two senses of your hearing and color, the sense of color?
When I listened to that, I heard a lot of orange and lots of very bright colors. I've always been a fan of cello melodies, so it was great to hear that.
And then eventually you get the higher strings coming in. They're also strings. Mm-hmm. Are they going to have a different color from your lower strings?
They'll have a little bit different. They have a different timbre, even though they're playing the same notes. So the violins there were a little lighter. They were more yellow than the orange cello counterpart.
Now, you've used the word timbre a couple of times in our conversation now already, and that's not a word that a lot of people use unless you happen to be a musician or deep into music. That is probably the most difficult term I've ever encountered, even as a musician, to try to define it. Help us out with your understanding of what timbre is.
Well, I've explained it to a few of my younger violin students as how the sound sounds, and they seem to kind of grasp that. So if you're listening to a sound, it sometimes it can be a really loud sound. Sometimes it can sound kind of angry. It can sound kind of, you know, soft and gentle. So there's all these different ways that the sound can sound.
Some certain way that the sound has its own unique quality that differentiates, say, an A played on an A flat played on a violin from an A flat played on a trumpet from an A flat played on a what have you, a guitar.
Yeah.
Timbre is just it's so elusive to me, and the senses, our experience of the senses, is kind of elusive too. I mean, have you given much reflection, not only to the fact that you perceive music with these colors, but that we don't necessarily even see colors the same way? There's no way for you and I to agree what I'm experiencing as green is what you are experiencing as green. And that kind of can leave you feeling a little lonely if you think about that too long.
Absolutely.
Is it isolating?
Yeah, it could be isolating if you view it from a certain way. But I think it can also be very empowering because no one else has the exact same experiences of the world that you do. That's something that just you get to have. And I think it's really cool that we can all have these different experiences and that they can be, you know, special just for you.
Let's talk about your work composing music, because you do have an album out. And I'm wondering to what extent you are able to sort of corral the music as music and produce music, to imagine the music, to write down the notes, to record it. Are you able to do that without having the colors play a role in the whole process? Or do you actually lean on that as though those colors are going to be important to your composition?
I definitely use synesthesia a lot in my music. When I was working on my album, which is actually titled Synesthesia, so that's kind of a dead giveaway. I used it in the formation of that. But as I was doing the mixing and adding in instruments, I could listen back and I could hear like, oh, there's a lot of green and blue, but I'm missing some yellow. And then I could know to go back and add a yellow sound or a yellow-ish melody just to make sure that all the colors are balanced. Because when all the colors are balanced, so is the sound.
Huh. I want to play the game again. It's kind of name that tune thing. Here's a tune that I've heard a lot in my home as of late. And to be absolutely honest, this is a little bit jackhammerish to me. Enough already. It's just, Ben, please, turn it off. I can't take too much of that because I get it at home all the time. Super Mario, of course. What's your experience of that electronically generated sound?
Well, before when we were playing Swan Lake and the piano music, the colors were very swirly. They had a distinct background and they were moving. And for that song, the theme song, it's very angular and sharp. Like the colors go away really fast. They're kind of like a quick little flash and then they disappear.
And that's not just with the staccato nature of that, because you hear these notes and they're little bursts of sound.
I think it might be because it's a burst of sound. So there's no sound that comes after staccato note. There's just silence.
So, but definitely with color, with each of those sounds, different colors, kind of like fireworks going off.
It is like fireworks.
Yeah. Well, before we say goodbye to you, Annie, I would like to go to this piece called Sleep to Dream. And I want you to set it up for us, because there's a great story about how you came up with this piece of music. It does have to do, I think, with a clock and you're trying to sleep. What happened?
It does. So in my room, I have a clock that hangs on my wall. It's an analog clock. And you know how those analog clocks can be. They just go tick, 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 and I just saw red, 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 and that was the sound that the tick of the clock was making. And it was so loud and so sharp, and, you know, at night it's so quiet that it made it almost impossible to sleep, because that red was all I could see and all I could hear. So I was like, man, it'd be really great if I could get to sleep. And I was remembering that the complementary color of red was green. So I thought it'd be cool to kind of make a song that was kind of a lullaby that would chase off the spread of the clock with, you know, counteract it with its other color, green. And so I made Sleep to Dream as a green song.
Is this instrumental? Is this vocal?
It is mostly instrumental, and there's some multi-layered vocals that I put in there.
So, Annie, I have to ask you something. As I was enjoying that, I heard harmony. And this is going to get just a little bit wonky. I'm going to push the edges. I know people can understand this. But if you're playing two notes side by side on the piano, there's a certain frequency thing going on there. And that note is going to be on pitch, or maybe it's a little out of tune. But you could slide between those pitches, and there's such a range. I'm just wondering if there's like a breaking point for certain colors. I'm wondering if you could actually align the colors you perceive with specific frequencies.
You know, I've never tried to do that. I know I've kind of noticed certain patterns, like usually an A is red, a B is pink, F is usually orange. But sometimes in certain contexts, those colors can change. And like in Sleep to Dream that you just heard, the scale for the first half of the song, the colors are mostly greens. There's some purples in there, some pink, some blue. I actually did an animation that shows you exactly what it is that I see. You can probably find it somewhere on my website. But that would be different than the normal colors that I would see if you just played the notes on the piano. So I think in that sense, they would be different. I don't think I could put them all, like line up a color to a certain note.
Annie Dickinson, a musician with synesthesia. Why do people climb high mountains? It's more complicated than just because the mountains are there. Tomorrow we're going to meet Vanessa O'Brien, the first American woman to summit K2. Hope you can join with me then. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.